Energy storage is important for the continued rollout of clean energy. However, a series of 29 fires at battery storage facilities in South Korea since just 2017 have called their safety into question. The research note behind today's episode is titled Ensuring Safe Use of Lithium-Ion Batteries, and it can be found at BNEF.com, at BNEF Go, on the Bloomberg Terminal, or via the BNEF app. Just as a quick reminder, BNEF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and we have a complete disclaimer at the end of the show. I am Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Bloomberg Switched On, the BNEF podcast. I'm joined today by Yayoi Sakine, and she leads BNEF's research on decentralized energy, alongside James Frith, who leads our research on energy storage. Let's hear from our guests. Yayoi, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And James, thank you for being on Switched On.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the very beginning here. What inspired you guys or actually got you guys to think that this was a important thing to start researching and looking at now, which is a lot of the battery fires for stationary storage in South Korea?
Yeah, I can take that. Just to kick off and give some context, the energy storage market is clearly growing quite rapidly. In particular, Korea has been a leading market in terms of total deployments in the world over the past 2 to 3 years. This year is probably going to fall off the ranks. But in that context, the market growing so rapidly also means that there is, I suppose, some slowness with regards to safety regulation or safety certification that has to kind of keep up with the pace of development of the market. And in Korea in particular, that has been an issue because we've seen multiple fires by this year. And in May, we actually, Korea experienced the 29th battery fire incident, which is quite alarming. So 29 different fires in different installations in Korea. So that really puts into question the development of the industry and what has to be done to ensure that we're deploying safe energy storage systems.
And this is 29 fires across, you said, 2 years?
Yeah, since 2017, at least in Korea, we've seen these incidents happening. And I guess in context, what we saw was a market that really boomed at the back of really generous subsidies in the market, which meant that a lot of generally inexperienced developers or integrators were essentially rushing to build out a lot of battery projects in the country, which also led to kind of rush on the edges to actually deploy these systems. And at the back of that, of course, we've ended up seeing a sad outcome around the battery fires.
So we're going to be speaking specifically about South Korea today. I mean, I guess it's more of a case study, but have there been fires elsewhere that are notable that provide context as well?
Yeah, so I think the reason why in particular, I guess at the 29th incident, this becomes particularly relevant, but I think what's more relevant contemporarily is Arizona Public Service, so utility in Arizona here in the U.S. They released a report regarding a battery fire that they had last year in April in 2019, and the results of that I think were quite helpful for us to understand the context of safety and certifications, not just in Korea but elsewhere as well. So that's kind of why we wanted to bring that conversation here today.
I think one thing to kind of just jump in and add as well is that I think we kind of are talking about battery fires focusing on Korea. Obviously, there was the APS one. NG had a battery fire at one of their pilot testing facilities in 2017 as well. And this gets a lot of in the battery community and the energy storage community, it gets a lot of attention. But actually, the 29 fires that we're talking about in Korea affect roughly about 5% of the total deployed capacity. So although it's a lot of attention, it's actually a relatively small amount of kind of deployed projects that are affected.
So Jameson, this brings us to a good point for us to try and understand, why do we think that these fires are happening? I mean, even within that 5%, ideally, they're very difficult to put out, and people really don't want these to be happening. So I suppose diagnosing what could be the issue is probably step one. Can you provide us with some insight there?
Yes, certainly. And I guess this is the kind of the million-dollar question. And I guess I kind of literally mean that, because there's obviously, huge kind of insurance liabilities associated with these fires. And determining you know, what the cause is, potentially influences, you know, who's insurance or who is liable for, you know, the project catching fire and the kind of any, you know, resulting costs that are occurring from it. And I think there's kind of, I suppose, a couple of things to look at here. There were obviously reports off the back of the fires in Korea, but as Yayoi mentioned, there was recently, you know, the APS fire report that was published about a month or so ago, which was quite enlightening, shall we say, in the kind of cause of the fire. But just starting with the Korean fires, obviously, you know, the 29 fires there, there's a lot of work was done on that to try and understand, you know, what caused them. And while that work was going on, you know, there were certain safety measures put in place by the, you know, the authorities in Korea to try and prevent this from happening. You know, one part of that was limiting the capacity of the storage systems that could be used to about 70% of the total capacity. It was actually just as they lifted those regulations that we had the fire earlier this year in May. So that's quite interesting to see. But off the back of the kind of 29 or so fires in Korea, there was a report that came out and identified, I guess, four key areas that could be behind these fires. And just to kind of run through them quite quickly, and then I can dive into a bit more detail. The first thing that they identified was exposure to humidity. Obviously, moisture and electronics don't mix that well. Moisture in the inside of batteries mix even worse. So that's the first thing that they identified. The next thing would then be kind of defective battery cells or modules. Kind of building on the defective cell, I guess, you know, they said that potentially there could have been external damage caused to either the system or the cells and modules during construction. And finally, you know, it's possible that the battery management system was faulty and didn't control the systems within the kind of parameters that they were meant to. So this was kind of what was identified in the Korean fire incidents. And actually that kind of covers the full value chain from cell manufacturer down to kind of integrator and indeed battery operator. So there's, you know, a range of different areas to look at there. And also, you know, off the back of that, different recommendations on how you could prevent this from happening again. You know, leading on from the defective battery cell, and this is what a lot of people suspected could be behind it, because, you know, although there is a huge amount of safety considerations that go into designing batteries and building the cells themselves, the modules, the packs and everything else, you know, you essentially have a lot of energy contained within a lithium ion battery. And if something goes wrong with that battery, it can kind of get out of hand pretty quickly.
Could you explain really quickly what out of hand means? Because I know that, you know, for everybody listening, I know they're very difficult to put out. So you can't just have a fire truck come up and throw some water on it. But what else does out of hand mean in this context?
Yeah, certainly. So at the kind of base level, you have to consider the chemistry, and particularly the chemistry of the cathode, to understand the kind of safety requirements and implications of lithium ion battery. There's essentially kind of two families of cathode chemistries that are used. You have your nickel based cathodes and your lithium ion phosphate based cathodes. So the nickel based cathodes are considered to be high energy density. They have what's called kind of transition metal oxide based materials. And what happens is when the material itself is heated above a certain point, you find that oxygen starts to be evolved from that cathode material. For the lithium ion phosphate materials, there is oxygen in there, but it's locked in what's called a kind of phosphate anion. And it's harder for that oxygen to be released. You have to go to kind of higher temperatures. So with the nickel-based material, once that oxygen starts being released, once it gets hot enough and actually kind of oxygen is just released from the cathode, that's what then can cause a lithium-ion battery fire to fuel itself. If, you know, even in the case of adding water from a firefighter, for example. Some people out there, you know, might be familiar with I think they call them cherry bombs in the US, where you can chuck them in water and the fuse will still burn and it'll kind of go bang at the end. And, you know, that's the kind of self-propagation that you get with a lithium ion battery. It feeds its own kind of fire. So it doesn't matter if there's water, it's still going to keep going.
So on the topic of preventing these from happening, there is a lot of attention on trying to figure out which one or maybe all four of the potential causes is actually the primary cause of these fires. What's then happening from a regulatory standpoint? Because presumably there is a place that it, in terms of trying to ensure safety for the end consumer, since, you know, 5% of these actually are catching fire, that the government maybe has to play in South Korea. And what do you see coming down the pipe?
Yeah, I can give some context there. So I mentioned something earlier, which is the industry tends to develop, and because it's such a new industry, it's developing at a more rapid pace than certifications and often regulations. So it's a bit of a game of trying to catch up with the pace of growth and responding quite quickly when incidents happen. In the case of Korea, for example, what they immediately did was stop issuance of new permits for new projects. And then at the back of that, also required that the existing and operating facilities reduce their operating parameters. So essentially, you're not charging it up to 100%, or probably you're only charging it up to 80% or 90%, which is a bit of a problem as well, because the way the incentive systems might be designed might actually favor projects actually operating at a higher operating range, which isn't great, but they try to kind of compensate for that as well. So there's kind of that immediate response that has to happen. Then kind of secondarily is, okay, so now we have to review all the safety standards that are in place, make adjustments, and kind of push it out to the industry as a requirement. And these requirements tend to be either A, international, or B, local. So international in the sense of there are a few international bodies issuing certification, so IEC and NUL as well. So they essentially set up different certification metrics or certification standards for different parts of the system, as well as the system as a whole. And essentially, battery developers or system integrators are trying to get their systems certified by these bodies that generally have certifications that are accepted across different markets. At a more local level, and perhaps at a more dramatic level, you might see something like New York City having a much more restrictive certification and safety requirements, which might actually mean it just takes you much longer for you to get the permits and all the additional paperwork that you might need to actually get the systems installed in the first place.
And are these certification systems essentially leading to more reliable units being installed?
So, I mean, they're more compliant with the safety certifications that have evolved over time. So in a way, yes, they are more safe than probably what you would have seen installed 5 years ago. There's a general recognition in the industry that there's still work to be done. A lot of it is kind of trial and error as well. And trial and error not necessarily meaning a battery fire, but definitely doing a lot more testing and understanding kind of the operations of systems in place.
And you mentioned certification, and actually the South Korean government noting that they are not installing anymore, at least for the time being, until we figure out kind of, I guess, what the problem is. And the next question I have on that is, are these units being exported to other countries? And is this a fairly robust international marketplace for these that's kind of originating in South Korea?
Yeah, I'll just correct that. They paused it for a period of time, which is when they were basically doing the investigation to understand the root causes for the battery fires, after which they essentially issued new rules that new battery projects have to comply with, and then reopened permits for new project development. So since then, there has been additional projects kind of being permitted.
Okay, so we're back on. Good.
Yeah, I know. But I will say that the 29th battery fire incident happened in the context of kind of the new regulations in place. So it's a bit of a blow in the industry in that sense. But regardless, I think on your point and question regarding exports of batteries and the role of Korean manufacturers overseas, is I think for a lot of time, especially because Korea was that kind of first moving bigger market in the world, we had thought of the battery fires as erroneously, probably as a potential Korea problem, which is why in the context of the APS for battery incidents, this became more relevant. So yeah, LG Chem, Samsung SDI, a lot of the Korean players are major players in the global market and supply battery modules to larger utility scale and behind the meter projects globally as well. So in a way, there was a lot of concern for any company or developer who was integrating a storage system if they really cared about what was happening in Korea.
Well, and among these 29 fires, and I guess you're saying it's across the industry. So my question has to do with which companies are associated with these fires. Is there a correlation between a few, or is it just kind of across the lithium ion universe, if you will?
I think we can be specific with what we know. So just to give an example, and I know we keep going back to the APS facility. So the APS facility was integrated by Fluence, which is a joint venture between AES and Siemens. That particular facility, and these are all publicly disclosed information, that facility used LG Chem batteries. And so, I mean, you could try to point your finger and say this is an LG Chem problem. But as you like from reading the report, you'll see it's not just about the battery cells themselves. The safety of a system entails a lot of components that within them is ensuring the battery cell is safe. But as James kind of broke down in the Korea example, you have to ensure all the other elements are in place as well. So you have to have some form of suppression system, which is appropriate for batteries and not necessarily just for a regular fire.
So looking into this, surely there were some things that sort of came to your mind. And I know that, you know, we're researchers and we are not regulators, but what recommendations would you say that you guys have for the industry, and how would you like to see this carried forward?
I mean, it's an interesting question. I think what we certainly don't want to see is the industry being derailed by what is a relatively kind of limited problem. You know, I think we talk about the 29 fires in Korea in particular. Okay, there's the example of APS in the US and NG's pilot plant. But generally, you know, lithium ion battery projects kind of are fine, and we don't see these fires. And so, you know, I think it's more that we shouldn't scare the industry off and stop people from building these, but just being more aware of, okay, what are the risks and how can we prevent this from happening? And I think for me, you know, the main risk is this issue of lithium-ion battery being able to kind of sustain its own or propagate its own fire. So really it's about thinking of how you can kind of mitigate that from happening. So what improved fire fighting techniques can you put in there? And one of the things that people often highlight is being able to cool the cells down more. So you can't put it out with water, but if you can take the energy away from that cell, it won't get so hot that it will release oxygen. And so people are looking at using what's called liquid cooling in stationary storage projects. Now, this is something that's used in electric vehicles already, but to date, generally, stationary storage projects have used kind of air conditioning systems, essentially, because it's cheaper and easier to install. But I think we'll probably move in the direction where we see more of these liquid cooling systems coming into place.
Can I just make a comment on the liquid cooling versus air-cooled systems? And this is more of a personal anecdote. So we talked about the APS facility, and actually, like 4 days before the fire incident in the APS facility, I had visited the sister facility, which is kind of like a very similar specs to the one that actually had the battery fire incident, which is kind of scary, actually, because it was like just 4 days after. And then I was like, I was just at a facility that was very similar to it. But just to give you kind of a mental image of what that's like, it's a facility that's pretty much located in a very desert-like zone. So it's in the middle of a lot of like sand. It's close-ish, but you only in the distance could see like a specific neighborhood, which is essentially what they were trying to test with the battery facility. That particular neighborhood has a lot of rooftop solar. So they were trying to test different things on their distribution feeder, try different types of services with the batteries themselves. It's also, from a temperature perspective, it's like 40 plus degrees in the summer at peak times.
Celsius,
yes. So more than 100 Fahrenheit, which, I mean, for me, just looking at that facility, if you imagine, it's not a container, it's like a building system, but it's like under a beating sun. And so what really struck me going into that facility was actually the noise of the fans. It was actually hard for you to like talk to each other within the facility because there was so many of the fans that are located at the module level as well. Those were just like ringing into your ear. So it's like quite loud. So thermal management on a consistent basis obviously is important, but it's also quite interesting to see if we move towards a liquid cooling system, maybe we don't see as loud systems as the one I visited.
Let's continue going down that road. Take my mind to this physical space. How big is it physically? And then secondly, how much capacity does it actually store? Like how meaningful are these as a part of the grid?
Yeah, maybe I painted it as a bigger facility than it actually is. So it's a 2 megawatt, 2 megawatt hour system. Physically, we can look at the specs. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's more or less, if you imagine like a container, a little bigger than a container in case like it's essentially, yeah, you imagine a container with like walls built around that container. That's essentially kind of the size of the facility. So it's technically not a big facility compared to a lot of the large scale storage systems that we're starting to see come online today and in the coming years. So it's fairly small in that sense.
We're talking specifically in this context, really, though, again, about South Korea, but there are definitely other manufacturers that are looking to play a bigger role in this space. So specifically within the battery manufacturing rather than the automotive manufacturing of lithium ion batteries. Can you discuss maybe some of the other countries that might be looking at this as a opportunity and maybe the sorts of things they need to do or the sorts of opportunities that are available to them as there's this regulatory focus on the South Korean market?
I think probably the company or the countries to look at here is the two large battery manufacturers are really Korea and China. And Korea or the Korean manufacturers produce these nickel-based chemistries that I've mentioned. Whereas for the stationary storage market, the Chinese manufacturers are trying to push lithium iron phosphate chemistry that I mentioned earlier. And lithium, or some people kind of consider lithium iron phosphate to be slightly better suited for use in stationary storage because it's kind of not quite so prone to release oxygen as the nickel-based chemistries. And so it's kind of safety performance is slightly better than the nickel-based chemistries. And so the Chinese company is trying to, you know, deploy this in the stationary storage market. And actually at the same time, they're trying to expand globally because at the moment, the Chinese stationary storage manufacturers or manufacturers of batteries are very much focused on the Chinese market, but they want to grow as the stationary storage market grows around the rest of the world and the EV market. And so this awareness of the kind of safety of stationary storage projects could be the opportunity for Chinese manufacturers to kind of enter the global storage market. That being said, you know, there's an increasing focus on local manufacturing of batteries. And, you know, although companies generally start off by talking about manufacturing batteries for EVs locally, if you have a battery manufacturing facility, it could produce them for EVs, or equally, you could start producing them for stationary storage as well. So we could see, you know, a shift in who's supplying cells for stationary storage systems as a result of this.
And maybe this goes without saying, but can you just for our listeners sum up quickly why you think it's important for the stationary storage space to take off for the rest of the grid, perhaps?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a pretty known story, I guess, the growth of renewables in the context of decarbonizing our power system. Part of that will require more flexibility in the way we operate our systems because renewables essentially aren't a flexible technology. That's essentially where batteries come in, take advantage of dropping costs. You can start adding lower cost systems. And so from a grid and power system perspective, adding energy storage to balance the variability of the grid is kind of an important and increasingly important part of how we're going to construct our grid of the future.
Well, on that note, Yayoi and James, thank you very much for joining Switched On today. And here's to hoping they figure out what is causing the fires so we can see this important and critical industry take off.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Dana.
Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.